And we're continuing. And I wanted to cover again, does God exist? That whole question, we talked about it from a cosmological argument, is what they call it. Where we're talking that the proof from the creation and the cosmology, the universe itself, speaks of God. And we went through that last week. But this week I want to talk about another argument that people have used to point to the existence of God, and that's the moral argument. The moral argument. And let's take a look at a verse in the book of Judges to start her off here. Judges chapter 17 and verse 6. Judges 17 and verse 6, it says this. In those days, Israel had no king. All the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. Now, that was a period of time where they had no central authority as a nation. And it was actually a period of decline in the nation itself. And one of the characteristics of that time was that everybody did what was right in their own eyes. So, in other words, their morality was something that they personally determined. And if they felt like it was the right thing to do, that's what they would do. And if you have ever read the book of Judges, you know that was a really bad time. Whenever people get together and they all get to choose whatever they want to choose about what is right and wrong, you're going to have a chaos and conflict and all kinds of things that happen that are not good. And amazing things that happen that you never thought could happen, that would ever happen. When people get to choose and decide about their own morality. But, see, that's the thing. Where does this morality come? And why are some things evil and other things good? How do we come to that conclusion? How do we know that certain things are evil and certain things are good? It's a good question. Where does this knowledge, these convictions, these perspectives come from? Because everybody knows that there are some things that you will say are evil, that you consider to be evil, and there are other things you consider to be good. And you say, well, obviously, everybody believes that murdering innocent children is evil. That's, everybody does. I don't know of any culture or any people that doesn't say that murdering innocent children is evil. It's wrong. But then there's the other side, too, that everybody realizes that someone who's selfless and kind is good. That's a good thing. In almost every culture and every place in the world, you see somebody who's selfless and kind, you go, that's good. Well, where did we get that category? How did we develop those categories of good and evil? Where did they come from? Now, children, they demonstrate from a early age a sense of right and wrong, and have a finely tuned sense of justice. Even why did he get more ice cream than I got? That's not right. That's unjust. You know, they don't use those words. They just say, I don't like this, that they got more than I, how come I can't have more? You know, and so there's this sense that there's these values and this sense of morality that comes in. Now, where did they get that? Maybe they got it from their parents, or maybe they got it from the culture itself. But we do have these morals. We do have these values, so to speak, that we as human beings hold on to, that we will say determines how we treat each other, because that's basically what morality is about. That's the main thing it's about. It's mostly about how you treat others. How you treat others. And so morality is, we either determine as in our own family or our own lives or as a society, and we say that this is how we will deal with issues dealing with each other. As a group and as individuals, as a community, as a nation, we have these values and we have these the sense of morality that we will treat each other this way. And it's very important, obviously. Because just in the workplace itself, have you ever had gotten a new boss and their moral values were a little bit different than the other one? In fact, they're quite a bit different than the other one. And what was the office like? It changed. The whole atmosphere, the whole, you know, culture of the office changes because there's a new sheriff in town, and they have new rules of how things are to be done and how you're to do things and who you're, you know. In fact, they have their own way of dealing with each other. One is very laissez-faire. The other one is, boy, better toe the line or they are on you. And so they have this is the right way to do it and this is the wrong way to do it. And so in every area of life, whether it be how you run your family or how you run your business or how you conduct your marriage, they all are influenced and determined by the morals that you have, the morality that you have. It will determine what kind of life you have, because it's very important how you treat one another and how you're treated. So where does this morality come from? Where does this morality come from? And that's the big question, because as a Christian, I'm going to be saying that the morality is coming from God. These values, these standards, come from Him. Now, here's an interesting statement by Fyodor Dostoevsky. He says, if God is dead, then all things are possible. Or permissible. Well, I think it's possible, too. I know, just kidding. Permissible. I was just going off the top of my head there. All things are permissible, okay? So basically what he's saying is that as a person, if the concept of God, if there is really no God in reality, then you can do whatever you like. Because here's the kind of the bottom line. When someone says you can't do that, what do you say back? Who says? That's what you say. You say, who says? That's what happened to Jesus when he was teaching. The Pharisees didn't like what he said. They didn't like his teaching of right and wrong. And they said, who said you could say this? Where'd you get your authority? And that's the issues. Where do we get this values of how you treat people, the morality of how society is to operate? Where does this come from? If God is non-existent, where do we go? Where do these things come from? Is it just a matter of we had an election and we decided to elect a certain list of rules and the majority wins? There's all kinds of ideas where morality comes from. And I'm saying that whatever your morality is, it needs to fit with reality. Does that make sense? It has to be shaped by reality. So if your morality is out of sync with how reality is, then it's going to cause all kinds of problems. I'll get into that in a second here. But we need to look at who decides what is right and what is wrong. Is it a matter of my personal choice? As a Christian, I believe that morality points to the existence of God. In fact, it's interesting when you look in our own country, the founders of our country, when they wrote the Bill of Rights, remember that part of the early documents of our country? And it talks about we have inalienable human rights. Now, where did they get that idea from? The rights that we as citizens have in this country. They said, the Creator gave them to us. And they're inalienable. In other words, they are intrinsically in you as a person. As a human being, you have rights, period. And where did these rights come from? They came from the Creator. And because they've come from the Creator, people just can't take them away from you without violating morals of this country. This is how our country how we've looked at things. Now, in other countries, you don't have inalienable rights. Human rights are wishy-washy. But in here in this country, that you're always hearing people talk about, well, we're for human rights, and those rights have been formulating over time to where I think they've obviously slipped from this original perspective. It comes from our Creator, so it's not something that can be given to you by the state or by some other people or your group. It's something that's given to you by the Creator, and it can't be taken from you. These rights are yours, and they're not to be taken from you because they belong to you, and they were given to you by God. So when we look at how this came about, there are a lot of different theories about how morality came into being, because everybody recognizes that we have to have a sense of morals. We have to have a sense of right and wrong if a society is to function well. If you are to be able to deal with life well, you need to have a well-developed sense of morality. If you don't, chaos comes into your world. So one of the ideas that have been developing over the last 150 years is the whole idea that morality is a product of your evolution. Morality is a product of your evolution. There is no God. So where does morality come from? Well, they believe that you can find a good justification for morality in evolution itself. It is the reason why we are moral. And so you go, well, how does that work? Well, basically they're stating this. Reality is made up of material and energy and how they respond to the laws of nature. Okay, that is reality. So if you are material and you have energy, then you are made to, you are created to operate by the laws of nature. And these laws of nature have determined how you've developed, not only physically, but also on how you relate to the other parts of the world itself and inner other species and other human beings. So, for instance, because I've evolved by natural selection, there's certain activities and certain sentiments that I have and certain activities that I maybe have done over the generations of my DNA that have brought out the fact that my species survived because it was willing to defend itself when it was attacked. And that's just now part of my DNA, so that I defend myself. And it's nothing that I decided. It's something that's just instinctive. It's something that's a part of me. So when you look at this argument about morality from evolution, you have to recognize that you don't have a choice. Your actions are the result of natural selection. So, and it was interesting, I didn't get all these quotes that I had. I just said not to take too long. But there are a lot of different ideas out there that spring from this whole idea of evolution and natural selection determining our instincts, which are our choices that we will do. So, for instance, because you have developed a desire to cooperate in you as a species, that has been obviously bred into you through your development over generations, and it made it that your group of people survived and flourished. So therefore, you see it as a high value, although it's just actually the way you were evolved, to be cooperative and selfless in certain situations. But really, when you look at it, how do you, because they say it's basically instinctive, it's something that's part of your DNA. So the question that comes up to my mind is, what happens when your instinct conflicts with society. In other words, my instinct for survival conflicts with other members of society and what they say I should be doing. For instance, let's say, for instance, I embezzled a couple million dollars from a big corporation. And they have discovered it. And they're coming after me. And I also committed murder to cover it up so no one would find out. But they did find out. So I have someone who is actually, for a certain price, they've offered to provide me with a new identity and a plane to fly to another country that has no extradition treaty. And so what do I do? What's the moral thing to do? Well, survival of the fittest, right? Survival, my survival as a species. I need to get out of town. So my choice is I'm going to flee and go to that other country. That's the right thing for me to do. Okay. You can justify that because that's how it all works. Or if you feel as a person that evolution is the way reality works, and the way that we have come into being, and it is really the moral impetus, inspiration for us, then survival of the fittest is something that is just part of your DNA. It's part of who you are. And so if you're doing it with that cause, it's perfectly justified. In other words, when you look in history, and this is fascinating to me, that Hitler himself studied Darwinism and came to the conclusion that the survival of the fittest is a very important principle for how his country should be run. So he decided to help evolution along, and that certain races were either they're weaker, not as good, and they needed to be weeded out of the human species. And those that were of superior needed to flourish. So he justified his extermination of Jewish race and other gypsies and other Slavic races to have them eliminated, because he was only living by what he thought was the right thing to do, according to what evolution determined for him. So these ideas, after a while you go, wait a second, that's not how we're supposed to operate. And everybody has an instinctual revulsion to that, unless you're one of the brainwashed who happened to perpetrate this horrible crime. You look at that and you see that, and you see these camps of people starving and dying and being burned up and all the horrible things that were done to them as though they were nothing. You go, this can't be right. Well, how'd you come across that idea? Where did that come from? It didn't come from evolution. And so the evolutionists will say whatever is natural is good, because it's part of how you as a species has developed so that you can survive. And the survival of the species and flourishing of the species is a good thing. And which I thought was interesting, because how can that be? Where'd you get that definition of good? Where'd that come from? It just is. Species survive or don't survive. They just do or don't. Where's the qualitative judgment that it's good? So anyhow, move on. Get sidetracked here. But see, the next point is there are serious problems with morality based on evolution. For instance, which instinct do I choose when they conflict? In other words, I have all these instincts within me, and what do I do when they do conflict? C.S. Lewis put it like this. Says, but you will find inside you, in addition to these two impulses, a third thing which tells you that you ought to follow the impulse to help. and suppress the impulse to run. Run away. Now, this thing that judges between two instincts, that decides which should be encouraged, cannot itself be either of them. You might as well say the sheet of music which tells you at a given moment to play one note on the piano and not another is itself one of the notes on the keyboard. The moral law tells us the tune we have to play. Our instincts are merely the keys. In other words, the point is he's making is that you have maybe two different instincts within you, and they are not compatible, whether to run and get out of a situation or to turn and help somebody. And there's something that is inside of you that's neither of those instincts that is trying to help you to decide which one to take. Well, if you're an evolutionist, it doesn't matter which one you pick, because they're all valid. It's an instinct to run is for survival, it's good. If it helps and it helps you to survive, good. Either instinct is okay. So there's no way to discern what is right or wrong in those situations, whatever you feel like doing. If you are just the product of evolution, then you aren't responsible for your conduct, because that's just how you are. You have been determined by the evolutionary process to be what you are as a human being. And so your line of DNA has made you to be the person you are today. And so how can you be responsible for something that you had nothing to do with? I thought there was a cartoon, and I'm just going to take the little quote in it. It said this. And this is a guy standing before a judge, and he says, Your Honor, I'm not guilty by reason of millions of years of evolutionary selection for aggressive behavior. Now, that's kind of comic, but people actually do believe that that is true, that these things determine that. In fact, I was reading about a lawyer, Clarence Darrow. Have you ever remembered that name, Clarence Darrow? The Scopes trial? Well, a year before that, I think in 1924 it was, there was a trial of these two young men who come from a pretty affluent neighborhood, and they were going to college at the time, and they were reading Kant and talking about morality is relative and that it doesn't matter. And they decided to see if it doesn't matter, and they went out and killed a young boy just to do it. And his defense was that they're not responsible. It's just how their DNA made them have a proclivity to doing violent acts. And the judge decided that was a good argument. And, diminished capacity or some kind, I don't know, from DNA. And they didn't get convicted. So, there's these consequences. There are implications, and if you go out from these implications, there's horrible things that can take place because of how you believe morals are developed and where they come from. So here's another one, a statement. It says, there is no qualitative difference between humans and animals. So humans can be treated like animals. Animals kill the weak, so we also kill the weak. The survival of the fittest is the law that we follow. Another thing about that's a problem with this is that you can't complain about the problem of evil. It's just the way the world is. Animals killing animals isn't evil. It's just the way that things are. People killing people isn't evil. It's just the way it is. It's just part of the whole natural way the world works. So the whole thing about the idea that the material and the energy coming together through how it responds to the laws of nature somehow has created this system of morality for human beings, I think is found wanting when you match it up with reality and how it works. Here's another one that's very common. Another view of how morality is formed is relativity. Morality is relative to a person or his group, to persons and groups. So when you look at that, that is the foundation for morality, that it's relative and depends on who you are and where you come from, what group you're with. That has implications. So in other words, we have no right to push our morality on others. If I belong to this group and there's another group over here, they have their way of looking at things, their morals are just as legitimate as mine, because my morality has come from the group that I belong to, the culture I've come to. They do certain things a certain way. They have certain values and morals, and I have certain values and morals, but neither one of us is superior to the other, and we have no business telling each other how they should live. So we don't push our morality on anybody else. Anybody heard that idea? Okay. All right. So that's the kind of outworking of morality is relative. Okay. So when we look at that, basically they're saying another thing, that there is no moral standard binding on all people. There's no moral standard that's binding on all people. So what I think is good, what I think is right, is my standard. What they think is good and what they think is right is their standard. But I can't say, now this standard here is for everybody without exception. They don't accept that. That is not a possibility, because that's not how morality works. Morality is basically something that comes from you as a person, where you decide that this is how you're going to live your life. In other words, you ever heard this before, where someone says, you know what? I should be able to decide what's right and wrong for me. That may be right for you, but this is right for me. That may be wrong for you, but not wrong for me. There's this whole idea that morality is based on my own personal preferences and choices, or the group that I belong to, and we've all agreed to have these standards. But there is no standard that applies to everybody across the board. So basically, your moral standard is just your preference. It's just your preference. So if you decide that killing babies is wrong, well, that's your preference. Whereas another group of people decide it's okay to kill babies, well, that's their preference. It's a matter of preference. It's not a matter of a standard that you have to live by. It's something that you decided that this would be right, and the other group said it's not right. So that's their choice. That's their preference. And it's all a matter of preference. So there's no objective standard. It's all subjective standard. In other words, morality is in the same realm of, I personally think chocolate almond ice cream is the best. This person over says, no, I happen to like Rocky Road. I think that is the best. Well, that's your choice. That's your preference. So you can have those two discussions. Neither one of them is right. It's the personal taste. This one likes this kind of ice cream. The other person's like that kind of ice cream. That's their choice. That's their preference. Now, but when we get to morality, it's the same thing. It's a matter of your choice, what you prefer. I prefer that we live this way. I prefer that we live that way. I prefer that we don't murder people. I think there are times when it's good to murder people. And you can... When they are not following our law, when they don't follow our ideals of how a society should work, we should kill them. If they won't surrender and submit to our law and what we think is right, they should be killed. So that's murder's good. This over here said, no, we shouldn't do that. You know, there's this. It's all a matter of preference. So when you look at this idea that that's where morality comes from, there are serious problems with this moral relativism. There's a illustration I found of a woman who basically has adopted that as what she believes is the way to operate, how you treat other people and how you make decisions and what are your values is all based on cultural relativism. But the fact is, when you try to live that way, it's unlivable. It doesn't work. For instance, you can't charge others with wrongdoing. Carolyn Floral Laban, I think that's how you pronounce her name, is an anthropologist whose professional field is dominated by what she calls cultural relativism, a view that all moral beliefs are culturally created. That is, we believe them because we are part of a community that gives them authority, and that there is no basis for objectively judging one culture's morality to be better than another. Yet, she is appalled by practices in societies she was studying that oppressed women. She decided that she should promote women's interest in the societies wherever she worked as an anthropologist. But this created an internal conflict. How can she promote women's rights as opposed to what is believed to be right in the country she's working in? Her culture believes that you should treat women one way, and these other cultures believe that they should be treated in another. So how can she justify what she feels compelled to do? How can she say that the Western values are better than theirs? And she's in a conundrum. So what does she do? She decided to promote women's rights anyhow. She can't live with that. So you can't say something is wrong because that would be wrong. In other words, you can't say it's wrong to be intolerant. You can say, well, that's wrong. You can't be intolerant like that. Well, why? That's your preference. That's your choice. You can't complain about being mistreated because it's just your preference to not be mistreated. It gets bizarre. It just gets bizarre. As you look at it more and more, you find out, wait a second. No one can really live by this relativism because we don't really believe it. We really do believe that there are some things, some moral standards that everyone should live by. We just do. And we can say we don't, but we just can't really live by that consistently because it doesn't fit with reality. Again, morality, I believe, comes from God. So here's the final point. Morality is a reflection of God's character. Morality is a reflection of God's character, who he is. God is honest. God doesn't lie. God is loving, compassionate, good, kind. All these things that are part of God's character are reflected in his law. In fact, we have the Ten Commandments. Basically, remember, I think it's in Exodus 20, it lists those Ten Commandments. When Jesus, when he looked at those Ten Commandments, he says, I'll summarize them for you. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And there we go. So everything is based on that, how you treat other people. It's all about how God has designed us to live. In other words, when he created us with an instinctive sense of right and wrong that is with us, our conscience, and which can be not as consistent as it needs to be because of other things. But basically, he has given us a sense of moral right and wrong because he says, I created you that way. That's how you will thrive if you live that way. If you decide to live your life lying to everybody, guess what? Your life is not going to be very good. You're going to be isolated. You're going to be alone. No one's going to trust you. People are not going to like you. Your life is not going to go well. And so all these things that we find in from coming from God is that there are certain standards that are not, I prefer this one and I don't want that one. I like this one and I don't like that one. No. These are something that are true for everyone, no matter who you are, and doesn't matter how far society progresses, these standards stay the same. They don't change. So, morality is a reflection of God's character. So, conditions for objective morality, the conditions for it. First of all, you have to have objective standards. Objective standards. We talk about relative standards, which are basically your preference. Objective standards are something that's above all these choices that you refer to and that don't change, stay the same. They're objective. They're just there. Another part of having this objective morality is you have to have free will. You have to have choice. If you don't have choice, you can't have real morality. And when God created us, he created us with choice so that we can choose between following him or not following him. If you don't have any choice, there is no morality. You just are. You just do what you do. There is no choices. There is no morality necessary. Because, like for instance, if God said, you cannot stop loving me, you have to love me. There we go. And I won't let you do other things that conflict with that. So what morality is there? There isn't morality. You are. You just do the one thing. So real objective morality has to involve a choice. You have to choose. Also, it has to have intrinsic value of humans. In other words, has to believe in the intrinsic value of human beings. We have intrinsic value. That's where these human rights come from, because we are endowed with these rights, these things from our Creator. So a human being has to have value apart from what they do or their position or their whatever things that people use to value. You have a value that comes from your Creator, that you are valuable and important, period. Whether you're a cripple, whether you're mentally diminished and have diminished mental capacity, or whether you're from another race or whatever, all these things don't matter, because you are a human being and you have this value in itself. Those three components have to be in this objective moral definition. So here's the logic of this morality. It says this: every law has a lawgiver. Write that down. Every law has a lawgiver. Okay, we don't have laws that just pop on the books by themselves. Okay, we don't have signs that say the speed limit is 65 all by itself. Laws have been created. They have a lawgiver, a law writer, okay? So every law, moral law, has a lawgiver. So, therefore, there is a moral law. Okay, because it has a lawgiver, there is a moral law. The third point, therefore, there must be a lawgiver. Okay, that's just the logic of it, all right? So, read that again. Every law has a lawgiver. There is a moral law. We all recognize that there is a moral law because we all live by moral laws that some of us acknowledge or don't acknowledge. There are there because we know they exist. We don't live just by saying there is no right or wrong. We just live, it's not like the Hindu belief that right and wrong, there's no difference. They're all part of the whole, the unified whole. Right and wrong, they're illusion. The contrast between the two is an illusion. It's all unity. It's all one. So there's no such thing as evil and good. There just are. So you have to have, there is a moral law. We recognize that there is. And therefore, because there is a moral law and because every law has a lawgiver, there must be a lawgiver. All right, now, here's some things. If there were no moral law, we wouldn't be able to detect evil. We would have nothing to compare it to. When you have nothing to contrast it with, it just is. But because there is something to contrast with it, you are able to discern that this is, for instance, the word injustice. That's an evil. Injustice, right? Well, the word itself means no justice. You can't know what no justice is unless you know what justice is. Does that make sense? So if you don't have a moral law, you can't decide what is wrong. You can't decide what is evil. So in the whole idea of morality, you have to have some kind of standard that you're going to be comparing it to. And I think C.S. Lewis talked about this, where he talked about you don't know what a crooked line is until you know what a straight line is. If you don't know what a straight line is, you won't know what, you can't say that's crooked. You can't say it's crooked because you don't know what, that you don't have anything to compare it to. Okay? So, here's another point. Our reactions help us discover the moral law. Our reactions help us discover the moral law. Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, put it this way. Paul says, "Indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law, since they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them." Okay, let me just back up on that one, okay? So for instance, he's saying morality resides in the person itself. They know God has placed within them the law. They have a sense of right and wrong. And when they do wrong, their consciences start to accuse them. And when they do right, their conscience defends them. In other words, you innately have a sense of right and wrong. It may not be well developed in some areas, but it's there. Is that T-Mobile? Just curious. They're calling. Give you a good deal this week. So here's an illustration of this. One student, an atheist, wrote eloquently on the topic of moral relativism. He argued, "All morals are relative. There is no absolute standard of justice or rightness. It's all a matter of opinion. Like, you like chocolate, I like vanilla." And so on his paper, he provided both his reasons and his documentation. It was the right length and on time and stylishly presented in a handsome blue folder. After the professor read the entire paper, he wrote on the front cover, "F. I don't like blue folders." When the student got the paper back, he was enraged. He stormed into the professor's office and protested, "F. I don't like blue folders. That's not fair. That's not right. That's not just. You didn't grade the paper on the merits." Raising his hand to quiet the bombastic student, the professor calmly retorted, "Wait a minute. Hold on. I read a lot of papers. Let me see. Wasn't your paper the one that said there is no such thing as fairness, rightness, and justice?" "Yes," the student answered. "Fine, then," professor responded. "I don't like blue folders. You get an F." Suddenly, the light bulb went on in the student's head, and he realized he really did believe in moral absolutes. He at least believed in justice, After all, he was charging his professor with injustice for giving him an F simply because of the color of the folder. That simple fact defeated his entire case of relativism. The moral of the story is that there is absolute morals. And if you really want to get relativists to admit it, all you have to do is treat them unfairly. Their reactions will reveal the moral law written in their hearts and minds. Here the student realized there is an objective standard of rightness by how he reacted to the professor's treatment of him. In the same way, I may not think stealing is wrong, but when you steal from me, I definitely do think it's wrong. Okay, so we have this law written on our hearts. That's there. And it doesn't matter what you say you believe. It's how you react and how you really live. Does it fit with the reality of how life is or not? If we don't have an objective law, a moral law, we would have no basis for human rights. Again, going back to the illustration from our own constitutional documents, where it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed with their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Notice the phrase that says, they are endowed with their creator, by their creator, with certain unalienable rights. In other words, these authors of the documents of the Constitution believe that human rights are God-given, and as such, they are universal and absolute. They are the rights of all people in all places at all times, regardless of their nationality or religion. I mean, that was the basis for the reason why they were able to say, we want to separate ourselves as a government, as a people, from the rule of King George, because we have certain rights that we're being taken from us. But these rights have been granted to us by our Creator, and so therefore this makes our rebellion against the king legitimate. Okay, so that was the grounds by which they were able to write the Document of Independence and declare independence from England and set up the government that we have. So, another point, if there is no God, there is no way to say what is moral or immoral. C.S. Lewis was one such atheist. He believed that all of the injustice in the world confirmed his atheism. That is, until he thought about how he knew the world was unjust. He wrote, as an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? And man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of what a straight line is. Finally, if there is no moral law, and it doesn't exist, then there is no moral difference between behavior of, say, for someone like Mother Teresa and Hitler. Likewise, statements like murder is evil, racism is wrong, you shouldn't abuse children, they have no objective meaning. They're just someone's opinion, on par with chocolate tastes better than vanilla. So when we look at the scriptures, we see that God has put within us a sense of right and wrong. And these things of how we know what is moral, what is immoral, what is right and what is wrong, come from our Creator. It points to the existence of God. It's a proof, as far as I'm concerned, that God does exist. Because where do you get these from? We have really no answer to that question if you leave God out of it. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for who you are, because you are the definition of moral. All your ways are righteous, and all your laws are good. who you are is what we want to be. Lord, there are times when we make bad choices, when we don't follow what you say is true and what is right, and we suffer for it. But you, by your grace, have paid the price for our faults, for our sins, for our wrongs, so that we can be given new life, a life that's able to say no to wrong and say yes to right. Lord, may our lives be a beacon of what is the way to live in this world, the right way to live, showing compassion like Jesus, but bearing truth to what is wrong with courage. Lord, we thank you. We pray that you would continue to work in our lives your will, your good, your right. In Jesus' name we pray.